Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the education channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tom DeSena, from the Department of Communication, Journalism, and Public Relations at Oakland University. My guest today is William F. Eady, the author of When Communication Became a Discipline. In When Communication Became a Discipline, Eady argues that speech and journalism professors embraced the concept of communication between 1964 and 1982. They changed the names of their scholarly societies and journals and revised their academic curricula. Five of what Eady identifies as strands of scholarship became and remain central to this transformation. Communication is not a traditional academic discipline, but its scholars convinced their colleagues to understand and embrace it. When Communication Became a Discipline presents an argument with historical evidence that illustrates scholarly creativity at its finest. William F. Eady is Professor Emeritus of Journalism and Media Studies and the former director of the School of Communication at San Diego State University, where he was responsible for leadership of a large program that encompassed all aspects of communication, media, and journalism. Bill Eady was the Associate Director of the National Communication Association, where he worked with researchers and promoted communication research to a variety of audiences. He served as the first editor of the Journal of Applied Communication Research after it became an NCA publication and is the current editor of the Western Journal of Communication. His scholarship has focused on the development of the communication discipline. He is the recipient of numerous awards, including the NCA's Golden Anniversary Award for Outstanding Article Published in the Field's Journal. William Eady, welcome to the New Books Network.
So glad to be here, Tom.
I'd like to begin our conversation today by asking what brought you to this particular project, or another way to pose the same thing is to say, why this book now?
Well, this book goes back quite a ways. It goes back to when I was actually working for the National Communication Association. And we were at the time trying to defend communication as a discipline to a number of different audiences, including funding agencies in Washington, D.C., such as the National Science Foundation and the National Endowment for the Humanities. We were having some success at it, but it was tough because people would say, but you're not really a discipline. You've got too many other things here that you're working from. So what kind of argument can you make? And I started to try to make those arguments in conjunction with other of my colleagues at NCA. And eventually I was trying to pull all these things together. And I said, I need to write a book about this. And it took a while to write the book, but but I did.
So you begin the book with some of the problems associated with defining both the idea of communication as well as the concept of a discipline. But before we get into this chapter, I just want to pose a question. And as a little bit of context, let me say that several years ago, I wrote a piece for a fairly well-positioned journal. It's not one that's housed in any of the scholarly associations you discuss in the book, but it's one that's reasonably well-recognized. And in the initial draft of this essay, I referred to communication as a discipline. The editor then sent it back to me with the comment that as far as he was concerned, communication was not in fact a discipline, but something closer to what he wanted to call a field. Now, at the time, I was just desperate to get my name into print, so I would have called communication a leprechaun if he'd have asked me to. But my question is, what do you see as the stakes involved in referring to communication as either a discipline or as a field?
Well, a field is a weaker term, and I think it's a term that people who are suspicious of communication want to lay on us, because they will say, well, you have too many irons in the fire. You come from too many directions at once. Yes, communication is a worthy area of study, but how you study it is in so many different ways. And you're not a science, you're not a social science, you're not a humanity. So therefore you can't call yourself a discipline. So we'll call you a field, and you need I hate to say this, but basically, I think the underlying message was you're not worthy enough to be called a discipline. So I thought, well, I'm going to start calling us a discipline, and then I'm going to defend that. And I think if I can get the rest of our scholars to start calling us a discipline and thinking of ourselves as a discipline, that we might lose some of this inferiority complex that we've saddled ourselves with, or we've allowed ourselves to be saddled with by other disciplines who think that we're not worthy of their time or of their money if they're a funding agency.
Yeah, that's an important point to raise. So in chapter two, you offer some histories of the major scholarly associations in communication, including the National Communication Association, the International Communication Association, and the Association for Education in Journalism and Mass Communication. You divide these histories roughly into two, the communication story and the journalism story. Can you tell us a little bit about how these scholarly associations adopted the term communication and what it meant for them to do so?
Well, the speech folks were anxious to remove speeches as a definer of what they did. And so they found communication to be a good term to be able to use. Now, they fought amongst themselves about how to use it and what kind of emphasis it should have, but they liked the term communication. Journalism, on the other hand, liked the term journalism, and they adopted mass communication. I won't say kicking and screaming, but they did because they had some very well-known scholars who started studying mass communication, and they decided that they really needed to have that as part of journalism. But journalism was always the label that scholars in that discipline were trying to use for themselves. But on the other hand, it was always a fight between the journalism professionals, the people who had been journalists and who were now teaching journalism, and the scholars who wanted to have some kind of an academic and theoretical basis, and not just simply people who wore eye shades and worked on manual typewriters and you know, hit deadlines for their copy. They're both fine disciplines, and I argue that they're both part of a much larger discipline of communication. Journalists may disagree with me about that, however.
So in the third chapter, we get to kind of the heart of things, the period 1964 to 1982. Tell us a little bit about why these years were particularly important to the formation of the discipline.
Well, there were markers at each end, and interestingly enough, the markers were in journalism. In 1964, the journalism folks were still figuring out what their scholarly society should be like. And they had a meeting where they were debating all of this. And what they decided at this particular meeting, without a lot of fuss, was that they should let the scholars into the association. So the mass communication people joined the association kind of with the other scholars, the journalism teachers, kind of kicking and screaming at the time. But they did allow the researchers to have time at their annual meetings, which they had not done in the past. The mass communication scholars had to go to the journalism meetings and then hold what they called rump sessions, separate from the journalism meetings. So now all of a sudden they could petition to start interest groups within the journalism society, and they could have their meetings in conjunction with the main journalism meeting. And that was a big deal. And in fact, there were quite a few types of scholarly research that became established as interest groups within what was then called AEJ and Association for Education and Journalism. And they it just kept growing and growing. And on the other end of things, 1982 also had a marker, and it was also a journalism marker, because that was the year that AEJ decided that they needed to add mass communication to their name. So they went from being the Association for Education and Journalism to the Association for Education in Journalism and Mass Communication. Now, interestingly enough, mass communication was an outmoded term by the time they got to it. Media studies had actually become a term that had a lot more currency by then. But the journalism scholars went kicking and screaming to changing their name, and they still had a lot of trouble with it into the end of the 20th century. I'd say if you talk to journalism folks now, they would embrace the concept of mass communication. They would also embrace the concept of media studies, but their association has this name, and they're not going to change it. It's going to be very hard to change again.
So from there, we go to the sort of the main part of the book, which are the five strands of communication scholarship, and I want to talk about each one of these in turn. You begin with communication as the formation of change of individual and public opinion.
Yes. And this is how I got these strands was to go back and look at how scholarship developed both in speech and in journalism, and try to find some topics that I could give names to that were common to both speech and journalism. And so they may be a little tortured at times. This one I think is, but they try to embrace each of these tries to embrace both areas of the discipline. Both traditions of the discipline, the speech tradition, which goes back into the, both of them go back into the decade after the turn of the 20th century. And speech was focused primarily on public speaking and on speaking activities. And they embraced communication as a way of having a theoretical base. And journalism eventually did the same thing with mass communication, but it took longer, and it took having really fine scholars develop work in mass communication and get prestigious appointments at at very fine universities, and then the journalism teachers were happy to be identified with that as well, I think. Sure. But yes, you asked about formation and change of individual and public opinion. So there's a strand of scholarship in speech communication that focuses on persuasion and interpersonal persuasion. There's a form of scholarship in mass communication and that focuses on how public opinion is changed. And there were some very fine theories that were developed in mass communication that are still being researched today and still being taught today that were developed during that time. The speech people, their path was a bit different, and their theories have grown and evolved and changed and become far more numerous than those mass communication theories that were developed during this period. But
they both worked
on similar kinds of ideas.
Yeah, the mass comm ones do seem a little bit, maybe robust. They seem to have lasted a little bit longer.
Yes, and they did because not only were they good theories, but they had very strong individual people who started them and who became identified with them and who trained graduate students in how to use them and who made sure that those theories were continued to be researched and developed. And speech didn't encounter that. Didn't go in that direction.
So from there, we move on to communication as language use.
Yes, and we would think that's something that would be just intuitively obvious, and it is, but people took a lot of different approaches in terms of how language is used, and you had more approaches in speech, which again is a pattern, and in journalism you had language use was sort of subsumed under other theories. And it became ways of looking at how of analyzing rather than being an integral part of the theory. So you had content analysis, which was really developed in journalism and became a critical tool for how journalism scholars do their work, and that kind of analysis has its strong points and its weak points, but it is something that has, like a lot of what goes on in journalism, it is something that became institutionalized and has survived.
So then communication as information transmission.
Well, this is the one that when everybody thinks about communication, they think about where to start. Yeah, and it's third because it's not where it started. It's actually, you can find things back for public opinion and individual and persuasion research. You can find things for language use that go back further than this information transmission idea. But it was started after World War II, mm-hmm. and it was started because technology was coming to the fore, and there were theories that were developed not by communication people but by mathematicians, yeah. And by people who called themselves cybernetics, scholars who studied cybernetics or how people figured out what transmission was about, because after World War II, the country decided that in order to have a thriving economy, which it did in the 1950s, they had to have better communication technologies. So they had a telephone, but telephone lines were not necessarily very very easy to deal with, because not only were they oftentimes shared by it with other people, and I'm old enough to remember picking up the phone and having an operator say, "Number, please." And, mm-hmm. and also having party lines.
I remember party lines too.
But it was so communication. You had to have a theory of how to, if you were say had some kind of interference on the line, and it was an interference that was helping that happened periodically, but happened in a pattern. And say it was taking out every fifth word. Could you figure out the message? And what they found was in their research was yes, you could, because it would be a pain, but you could. And that's because language itself is redundant enough to allow, and grammar allows for redundancy. So it you can understand the message even if you couldn't hear all of it, or if there was interference. They talked about it, the concept is noise, but it was any kind of interference that would be in the channel. And this was a very appealing model and was adapted for human communication. And it turned out not to be such a great model for human communication, but it was the idea was, yes, you had a source, a message, a channel, and a receiver, and those were the elements. And that lasted for quite a while before people decided that wasn't quite sophisticated enough for what we were really looking at.
But it persisted. I was, a few years ago, did an assessment report for our department here, and we had to delve back into the founding of our department. This university is relatively young. We were, founded in the 1950s, and the Department of Communication was even later than that. And we were started by a Harvard-trained psychologist who got attracted to questions of communication through the lens of cybernetics. And that person was then motivated by a theater teacher to begin a department of communication. So,
and there you go. Yeah. you've identified both ends of the discipline.
and here we are. So the next chapter in the book is communication as developer of relationships. Can you tell us a little bit about what goes on in scholarship related to this idea?
Well, this idea actually dates from other famous scholars. It dates from the work of Gregory Bateson, who was an anthropologist and who was married to Margaret Mead. And interestingly enough, Wilbur Schramm, who is one of the key figures in the discipline, shared a carpool with Margaret Mead during World War II, when they both worked on propaganda research and how to counter propaganda that was being used during World War II. The speech people latched on to this developer of relationships and they decided in their wisdom that this was an interesting context to study. They used the word context. And so you could have one-on-one communication. You could have people communicating in a group, or you could have people communicating one-to-many, which would be public speaking, which is where they started. So this was an elaboration of what the speech people were already doing, and they were trying to figure out what was unique to these individual contexts. The journalism folks approached it somewhat differently. They were looking at, they were looking at how journalists developed relationships with not only sources, but also that they develop relationships with technology so that you had some trust in technology, maybe that would work along, and you would be able to learn how to communicate, not just via technology, but to use technology to your own advantage. So this was the idea of a relationship was something that was that was important to both groups, but much more important to the speech communication scholars, and they went through this period where they were studying the context, and then they realized that no, what they were really studying was relationships, and Gregory Bateson's work was adopted by Paul Watzlawick, who was a Stanford psychiatrist, I believe, and some colleagues, and they wrote a book called Pragmatics of Human Communication, which again was not from people in the communication discipline, but was hugely influential and changed the way that kind of study was working.
So the penultimate chapter you describe as communication as definer, interpreter, and critic of culture. So what's going on here?
Well, there's two different strands at work in the same in the same label here, and one of them is how does culture influence how people communicate, and you can look back to Edward Hall, the great anthropologist in the silent language, and how he decided that how he identified nonverbal communication as a key component of the communication process, and how he identified culture as influencing how communication was used and developed, and Hall was. Hall's work was very influential, especially among speech scholars, although journalists were interested in it too, because it influenced how they would communicate with people from other cultures. So the one strand is how do people communicate within their own culture, and how do people communicate across cultures? But then there was this other strand that came along, and it developed out of work in Britain by Stuart Hall, who was a media scholar. And this was actually key in the development of the idea of media studies. And what Stuart Hall talked about was how media is its own culture, and how media develop cultural expectations in people who interact with it, and he was looking at the whole notion of society and how society was built via media use, and that became something that was quite well used, and was something was new and exciting. And there were actually a couple of different strands of that too, but I think I'm going to let you read the book in order to find out about those different approaches to cultural studies. But cultural studies has become a major way of looking at communication, and it also influences a lot of current scholarship in communication.
So In the conclusion, you offer a reassessment of all of these strands as they continue sort of post-1982, but also you gesture towards what you think might be some new strands that are taking shape. Can you describe those for us?
Oh, wow. Yes. You got me. I gotta look. And what I, performance. Yes. Okay. There were a couple of other strands.
Yep.
That I thought, and one of them was the idea of performance, and performance is a concept that has been, it's a slippery concept. It's been used in a lot of different ways. And again, people in speech communication, which eventually, by the way, transitioned to you to just use the word communication or use communication studies as being the way of labeling it, but they dropped speech ultimately because it was part of their tradition, but it wasn't the way that they, it didn't really describe who they were, and it gave people the wrong impression. But performance was definitely part of speech, and it was a way of focusing on how people gave speeches, and the and that the so it was also a way of how people could interpret literature, and there were even journals that were developed and lots of scholarship, and performance has finally transitioned into being something that's used as an ethnographic tool. So if you're looking at how cultures operate, part of what you can do is you can look at how do they perform what they do. I have a colleague at San Diego State who looks at disability as performance and how people with disabilities alter their communication and in some cases have their disability influence their communication, in some cases have it define their communication with other people. And this is all fascinating work, I think. The other one was, I'm sorry. I'm forgetting what the other one does. In the end,
Developer of identity.
Developer of identity. There we go. All right. And in fact, that leads from this work on performance. The two of them are interrelated in some ways because we perform our own identities, and you can look at them from a performance standpoint. But you can also look at identity as what groups do you identify with? So we have a Black Lives Matter movement going on in the country, and it's an important movement. And people who are identifying with as either being Black or as being part of a culture that has been oppressed. And that needs to be lifted up in positive ways. And so Black Lives Matter is a positive force for lifting those kinds of things up. And you've got critical race theory that isn't really specifically a communication theory, but has also influenced those kinds of things and has become a catchword for what's wrong with the country in some quarters, unfortunately, but you get yourself identified and you do things, you come up with theories that are interesting to people, and there will be people who will pick up on them and try to turn them around and use them for other purposes. And so I think that's in general a positive thing about communication is that people are paying attention to our scholarship and they're using it for their own purposes, sometimes in positive ways, sometimes not in such positive ways.
So at the end of the book, you pose the question that communication became a discipline during this time, and then asked the question, but did it remain one? And so I'm wondering, we're 40 years past 1982. Do you see communication as a discipline as still a live question? And I guess what I mean is that I've also served on a committee that vets new programs. And recently, one of the ongoing, we'll call it a frustration, I suppose, is that almost every program that was trying to be introduced to the university curriculum had to take great pains to describe itself as interdisciplinary. And to the point where a lot of it kind of strained credulity when they were calling themselves that. And I'm wondering, since communication, you know, even the way that we've been talking about it today, is so transdisciplinary, do you still see this as a live issue for us?
I do. In fact, this was when my book was reviewed, and the reviewers were very helpful. I found that they asked the question of, well, isn't communication really interdisciplinary? And so I had to go back and do some research on what is interdisciplinary, and I found some very good scholarship from other disciplines, and I came to the conclusion that communication has some components of interdisciplinarity, but it doesn't fit the model exactly. What communication has done as a discipline is that it's been on this path, and it as a lot of disciplines are, it's been on its own journey, and as it's developed, it has grown and changed, and sometimes people are still working in lines that were developed a long time ago, and in some cases they're working on pushing the envelope forward with new ideas and new ways of looking at things, and that can look like interdisciplinarity, but I think that I take comfort in that these five strands that I identified are still being researched and are still being developed, and all of them are still important parts of a communication discipline. So that's why I think that we may look interdisciplinary, but if you break it down more carefully, you find that we really are just a complex discipline. You can't put a label on us, and that's because of our history and how we tried to shun the idea that we were a field, and embrace the idea that we had something to contribute, but it was multifaceted.
So before we wrap up today, let me ask, and here recognizing that you are an emeritus professor, what are you working on next?
Well, I've had a project that I had to put on hold in order to work on this book, and it's a project on a particular scholar's work, and how that scholar's work developed, and how it had been used. So this was a scholar who tried to develop a concept of how people develop meaning, how people develop and use meaning. And he came up with a very strong and very complex theory. And unfortunately he died at a relatively early age. And his wife, who was working with him actually on developing consulting uses for this theory, and had come up with a number of them, wanted to develop a book on it. And I had said I would work with her on it. And I think that's where we're going. We'll see. How we would divide that up would be, I would work on discussing the theory, and she would work on discussing the application. And she's been very successful as a communication consultant. And I think applying our work and using it in practical settings is really important.
Well, very good. We'll look forward to hearing with that when it comes out. Let me know and send it along.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
So, Billy,
thank you for being interested and wanting to talk to me about it.
Oh, very good. Once again, my guest today has been William F. Eady, the author of When Communication Became a Discipline from Lexington Books, an imprint of Roman and Littlefield. My name is Tom DeSena, and you are listening to the New Books Network.